I'm Bert Cohen. Time for Portside. And we are, of course, living in the USA, where people expect instant results, instant gratification. We got to have our answers now. We got to have our change right now. Barack Obama was elected to bring change, and there's a lot of question as to, is he really bringing change? How much power does the president, this particular president, really have? There have been powerful presidents. There have been not so powerful presidents. Where does Barack Obama fit in? I'm Bert Cohen. We'll be talking with Stephen Hill, a political writer and columnist. Steve, thanks for being with us today on Portside.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, let me tell our listeners a little bit about you. Steve Hill is a director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation and co-founder of Fair Vote, Center for Voting and Democracy. His next book, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. It'll be published in January. We'll have to talk about that one, too. His previous books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics. Boy, those are some big subjects as well. Well, a lot of people are asking, where's the change? Some people, I've seen a bumper sticker that says, how do you like the change so far? That's from the people on the right, obviously. But the where's the change crowd on the left, those who believe that Obama has turned out to be little more than a compassionate version of George W. Bush. Is that a fair description, do you think?
No, I think that's overstating it. I think there was perhaps too much expectation and optimism about what any president can do in the American political system, given both the structures of the political system, for instance, the Senate, which is probably the most unrepresentative body outside Britain's House of Lords, and as well as just the special interests that dominate a money-marinated system. So, you know, there's been all sorts of hope that Obama could really reverse the course of a huge ship that you just can't, it doesn't turn on a dime, even with a new captain on board.
That's for sure true. And I've heard the Senate described as the place where bills go to die. And Stephen Hill wrote an article called Obama the Impotent, which is, you know, it's stimulative language to say, the impotent, but you're right, turning a huge, huge ship, and I think that's a good way to put it, just it can't turn on a dime. And you say that so far the world has seen more symbolic gestures from the Obama administration than accomplishments. Could you specify on that? What did you mean?
Well, if you look at some of some of the initiatives that Obama administration has taken. So, for example, on changing the miles per gallon of automobiles, it took years for us, for the United States, to change anything along these lines, and we had gotten quite behind the rest of the world. And so, when the Obama administration actually finally made a change to boost it to 28 miles per gallon fleet-wide, that's a number that won't go into effect until 2020. Well, Europe and Japan long ago reached that level. China has already reached that level. So, you know, while there was lots of people in the United States saying, oh, well, change has happened. The Obama administration made this change. The Bush administration refused to. I thought it was an example of just kind of the underperformance that has come to dominate American politics, where we have really fallen quite behind the rest of the world in so many ways. We don't have, for example, paid sick leave. Most of the world has this. In fact, there's only about four or five other countries, tiny, small, impoverished countries, that don't have something like paid sick leave for workers. And what that means is that we have encouragement for workers to show up to work sick, and they get their coworkers sick. If they're handling food, they get their customers sick. So even from a financial standpoint, it makes absolutely no sense to have something like that. And yet, you know, there's really no movement in the Congress towards bringing the United States up with the rest of the world in many, many ways. I mean, we could go on and on about the many ways the United States is just kind of becoming a rogue nation in these sorts of things.
Hadn't thought of the U.S. as a rogue nation before, but I suppose compared to Europe, and I certainly look forward to that book about why the European way is the best hope.
And it's not even just Europe. Japan, Australia, Canada, I mean, most of the established democracies in the world have done all these things. And we're the ones that are just way, way behind. And we try to make these arguments, these economic arguments about, well, if we do that, it's going to hurt our economy. Well, I mean, the rest of the world has already done these things, paid sick leave, paid parental leave when you have a child. You know, they have universal health care. They have free or nearly free university education. And why is it that, you know, the rest of the world, their economies are able to make the transitions into this kind of next stage of a nation state, and the United States is stuck in the old stage, and yet we still sort of somehow see ourselves as the leader of the world? It just defies common sense.
Well, we are certainly not leading the world in terms of health care. I was lucky enough to get to Europe this summer, and, you know, people over there are just, they cannot figure it out. I have a hard time figuring out why people are so opposed to making the change to make it from, you know, healthcare as a rare privilege to healthcare as a right. It's good for the economy, clearly. But it brings us back to where the power in this country really is. And I think it's fair to say that for many years, America, perhaps to the world and to, I think, literate observers here, has looked more like a plutocracy, you know, government of, by, and for the very rich, than a real democracy. The power of money in Washington, it seems, can hardly be overstated, as you said. And power, as we all know, it's like a law of physics. Power doesn't give up without a significant struggle. And the plutocracy, the moneyed interests have had tremendous power, just an absolute lock on Washington for a long, long time. So isn't this a major factor in America's slowness to make this change? And they're not about to give up.
Yes, that certainly is a factor, though I wish it was the only factor, because if it was, we could just pass, you know, very strong campaign finance reform laws and be done with it. But I think it's more complicated than that. It actually involves the very basic structures of our political system. For example, using the single-member district system, which most of the established democracies in the world have either rejected outright or never used to begin with, in which we elect one representative per district. What that has led to is districts in which, you know, we can tell you right now, for example, for the 2010 election, who's going to win 90% or more of the districts in the U.S. House of Representatives. And so that means the representatives don't really have to run. They're not held accountable by anyone. We can tell you which district is going to be Democrat, which is going to be Republican, and which ones are going to be toss-ups, and there's, you know, very few of those toss-up districts. And so it means voters are taken advantage of, taken for granted. You have orphaned Democrats and Republicans, so you have millions of Republicans and Democrats across the country who live in the opposite party's district, and their vote doesn't really count for much. That leads to polarization in the legislature. And it's going to be tough to change that, even with redistricting reform, because a lot of it is a product of where people live. People have tended to self-select themselves into these enclaves of blue strongholds and red strongholds, entire regions becoming blue strongholds and red strongholds, to the point where it's really difficult to get any competition in our elections, no matter how we pass reform, unless we're going to just break up these single-member districts and go to some sort of proportional representation system. That really, I think, is what America needs at this point in its over 200-year trajectory, is a real shakeup to the political system. Of course, the way we elect the president, the Electoral College system, is confusing to Americans.
Yes.
Doesn't make a lot of sense compared to just a national direct election. So the United States really needs to look at some basic fundamental reform in a way that will shake up the system and make voters feel like their votes are going to count again.
Good point. We're talking with Stephen Hill, writer and columnist, director of Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. And, you know, we talk about the power of money and how difficult that is to change. And it goes back to, I think what you're saying here is the winner-take-all problem. You wrote a book about that. And correct me if I'm wrong, was it Lonnie Guinier who got in trouble for talking about that in the early Clinton administration, or was there a different person?
No, Lonnie Guinier had been nominated for a position in the Department of Justice under the Clinton administration. And in her previous writings, she had written about ways to give minority representation, and she was thinking in terms of racial minorities, without having to rely on single-member district systems, because when you use that system to give racial minority representation, you start carving up gerrymandered districts based on race. And that creates a lot of issues, a lot of problems. So she was putting forward other ideas about how to give fair representation to racial minorities without having to use, you know, carve up these districts. And she proposed a few methods like cumulative voting and others that were very thoughtful essays, if you really actually read the essays. But the right got hold of that.
Yes.
And, of course, tried to, make it into a polarized debate and tried to stereotype Lonnie Guinier as the quota queen. And, in fact, the method she was proposing was anything but quotas. They were the exact opposite. They were creating competitive elections, and it would have done things that Americans would have liked, I think, not only for racial minorities, but for, as I said, there are millions of Republicans living in Democratic districts. Their vote doesn't count either. There are millions of Democrats living in Republican districts. Their votes don't count. So it would have really given more Americans the sense that their vote counts for more if they had actually tried some of the methods that Lonnie Guinier was advocating for.
Well, I wonder how much change can be done if we don't switch over to proportional representation. And are there other, you know, modern industrialized Western nations that have more proportional representation? I would imagine there would be, so that a minority can have some say, and it's not totally winner take all. So if it's 51-49, as it often is, the 49 gets shut out. They lose. And wouldn't it be better if there was some way to have some participation in there? And I wonder how that might affect the ability for this large ship of state to make a change that it needs to be.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful and healthy for American democracy, because what you see in these sorts of methods, like, for example, to use a proportional representation system like Germany has, what you see is generally you have about 5 or 6 political parties, and 2 of them are major parties, like our Democrats and Republicans, and then the other 3 or 4 parties are minor parties, what we sometimes in the United States call third parties, whose influence and number of seats in the legislature ebbs and flows with,
sure,
with the issues of the time. So what you get is this very healthy discourse between the margins of your political spectrum and the center of your political spectrum, where the different parties and their proportion in the legislature goes up and down depending on what the issues of the times are. And that, in turn, gives voters more, you know, they feel like they have more to vote for, because now you can look out there in the political landscape, and instead of just seeing, you know, just Democrats and Republicans that really have any chance of winning, and as I said, in most districts, we really don't even have a two-party system. We have a one-party system. Your choice as a voter in the American political system is to ratify the candidate of the party that dominates your district or even your region. And so it's really not choice in any meaningful sense, whereas in these other methods, you as a voter will be able to look out there in a political landscape, and it's 3, 4, 5, 6 parties that have a chance of actually winning, and vote for a party that you really believe in, instead of always picking the lesser of two evils, as so many voters do in the American political system.
Well, that's true, and I can imagine that right now there's a struggle for the soul of the Republican Party, certainly between the more traditional conservatives and the rather extreme fringe that's gotten all the news lately. That's kind of a struggle for the identity of the Republican Party, and certainly the Democratic Party has had that as well. You have your Ralph Nader voters and Green voters and different issues like that. So if there were other parties that perhaps could be power brokers, then that might make it actually more democratic with a small d, more participatory. Well, you know, it's easy to talk about this too as well, but it, you know, it's like, how do we really make change in America? People voted big time for change. The winner took all. It was Barack Obama. He is president now. And you argue that Europe has been increasingly critical of America's failures to live up, for example, to its global responsibilities. Could you talk about that a little bit? What's Europe critical?
Sure. There are two areas, possibly three, in which Europe is both losing patience and there are potential conflicts down the road between Europe and the United States, and actually I would say even between the United States and most of the rest of the world. And those three areas have to do with global climate change, reform of the financial system that completely melted down over the past year, and then also in the ongoing wars in the Middle East. And in terms of global climate change, the thing that you have to understand is that the United States is the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases. I mean, China may be passing us, depending on how you measure that, but you know, we're certainly, if not first, then we're second, but we're by far the largest per capita emitter of carbon and other pollutants. China has about four times more people than we have who all belch far less individually. And so, in fact, I just saw one recent measurement that an average American uses four times more carbon than the average Chinese individual. Wow. So even in terms of, in relative terms, we might be the same as China, but in terms of per capita terms, we are by far the largest per capita polluter of carbon in the world. And Europe has done all sorts of things to really lower their what's called the ecological footprint to the point where their footprint is only half of what ours is for having the same standard of living. So they've done things like they have smaller houses, they have smaller car engines, they have started putting in renewable energy, they have put in place all sorts of conservation measures like having the chlorofluorocarbon light bulbs that are emit about a quarter of the wattage. They've done all sorts of things to insulate their homes and in their businesses and their schools. They've besides renewable energy, they're starting to look at other technologies like hydrogen and fuel cells and all these sorts of other sorts of things. They have some amazing, one of my favorite examples is off the coast of Portugal, you have these big, huge floating tubes that as they bob in the waves are connected to a piston that basically is creating energy, and then they can connect coastal towns that it's hard to run electric lines over the land to them, so you can power them through these bobbing sea snakes, as they're called. And so Europe has just embarked on all sorts of interesting ways to reduce their carbon emissions, and the United States, really, we've done hardly anything at all. And so, you know, the world is losing patience with the largest per capita polluter in the world. So that's one example. Financial system reform, you can also see that there, I mean, you know, the rest of the world sort of sees the United States as having been the cause of the recent global meltdown. Not that other countries didn't participate in their own way, but it basically started as a byproduct, a pollutant, if you will, of Wall Street capitalism. And so they're looking to now put into place certain financial reforms that are going to make sure it never happens again. And once again, we see who's dragging its feet. It's the United States and the Obama administration, Timothy Geithner. It seems like he represents Wall Street interests sometimes better than he represents Main Street interests. And everyone, of course, realizes we have to get the economy going again, and we can't do we can't overreact to the point where we prevent the economy from rebounding. But that's not what this is about. This is about making sure that bankers who control institutions that are quote too big to fail, right, don't have continued incentive to do the types of practices that caused them to take such enormous risks that that they did fail. And the United States had to basically socialize the losses while the banks privatized the gains.
Well put, my goodness. Well, that brings up, you know, how can you make these changes? You talked about the big steps ahead in terms of energy independence that Europe is making, the sea snakes or whatever they're called off Portugal there. I wonder if changes can come to the United States given where the power really is. You talk about how, you know, you want the economy to come back, and that's, in a way, the free market, although there has been kind of socialism for the rich for a long time, that the government props up the very wealthy. And the power of this country, it seems, is in the money, in the private moneyed interest. Whereas in Europe, my sense is that sector isn't quite so dominant. And I wonder if we, the United States, can make the changes that Europe would like to see, that most Americans really would like to see, without changing the locus of the power, sort of, you know. And you have these people out in the streets now, that the Tea Party people, saying, you know, they're really concerned about taking away freedom, and a lot of their funding obviously comes from, well, maybe not so obviously, the insurance industry and the big money people that equate freedom with the freedom to do whatever the heck they want without any government participation whatsoever. And I wonder how we can, you know, can Obama be successful in showing real leadership to control, you know, environmental destruction, and to make the changes that are necessary? Can it be done? I mean, is he a powerful enough president to be able to do this, or is some of the fault his?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, he's only been in office for, what, 8 or 9 months. But on the other hand, in terms of the electoral calendar, that's actually longer than I think many people realize. And so it really is going to test whether Obama, who, you know, let's remember, Obama was not the most experienced politician in the world. He'd served a few years in the United States Senate. He'd served a few years in the state legislature in Illinois.
Right.
Whether he has the ability... I mean, this was not someone who, for example, was Lyndon Johnson, who had been the head of the Senate for many years and then became president. And so when it came time to passing important legislation like the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which the two, you know, most important pieces of civil rights legislation since the end of the Civil War and the freeing of slaves,
yeah.
Johnson was able to, he knew how to twist arms, he knew how to get eyeball to eyeball with his colleagues and, you know, his... both in the Senate and the southern senators who were dragging their feet on these sorts of things. He also knew how to sweeten the deal for those who were sitting on the fence and, you know, give favors. And he really combined the carrot and the stick in a way that I really don't think we've seen a president with that ability since. And, you know, does Barack Obama know how to do this? So far, the initial assessment, I would think, is no. He's not particularly good at it. He seems to be learning on the job. And keeping in mind that he's going up against a body in terms of the United States Senate in which you need 60 votes to pass anything, 60 out of 100 votes. So 41 senators, and those 41 senators, especially when you look at most of them are going to be, you know, Republicans, in fact, all of them, and except for maybe he needs one Democrat to go against him, many of them come from some of the states where they don't represent very many people. The structure of the United States Senate, you have two senators in California representing 35 million people, two senators in Wyoming, for example, representing 500,000 people. So those 41 senators doing a filibuster may represent 20 to 25% of the nation who are able to thwart what the other 75 to 80% of the nation wants. This is the real barrier in the American political system that I think is going to continue to thwart Barack Obama's attempt to get the United States into the 21st century. We see this already playing out in healthcare. We see it playing out in energy, renewable energy reform. We see it playing out in continued funding for the wars that are going on in the Middle East. And this is going to be the real test of whether Barack Obama can figure out how to navigate his way through the United States Senate.
Boy, it is going to be interesting. And certainly during the primary process, the question was raised over and over again, is Obama too untested? Frankly, it seems like we're seeing the answer now. you know, and you talk about LBJ, who had political skills unbelievable, probably the most politically skilled president, I would think it could be argued, in the 20th century, because he had so much power in the U.S. Senate to get things through Congress. I wonder, how would LBJ handle the Blue Dogs? I mean, the Blue Dogs are those Democrats who, maybe dinos, Democrat in name only, who, you know, are very, very scared. They may come from red states, as it were. But LBJ might have been able to twist the arms of the Blue Dogs. How would LBJ have done that, do you think?
Well, it's kind of hard to say how he would do it today. The 1960s was a different time, but I think, you know, he, as I said, he used the carrot and the stick. So yes, he would typically sweet talk individual members of the Senate and of Congress. He would, you know, have presents sent to them, their favorite bottle of bourbon, their flowers. You know, he would ingratiate himself to them using all the legal means of bribery that a president has. But he would also get in their face, and yeah, you know, he would invite them into the Oval Office. And you know, you might have seen some of the photos where it has Lyndon Johnson kind of leaning over, yes, one of his one of the senators, and his nose is about a quarter of an inch away from the nose of the senator whose vote he's trying to get. And yeah, so, you know, these are, it's kind of, he in some ways was, you know, to, for lack of a better term, he had that redneck sort of veneer about him. It's hard to imagine Barack Obama doing something like, yeah, that. I mean, Barack Obama comes across as a graceful sort of person who, you know, tries to rise above that sort of fray. And he's made it a point to make that part of his personality, at least his public personality. And so, you know, is he willing to get down in the trenches and get pretty gnarly and nasty with some, yeah, of these people? That's what it's really hard to figure out at this point. And, you know, they say that Rahm Emanuel is supposed to be Barack Obama's pit bull, and that's why Obama picked him for the position that he has. But from what I've seen so far, Rahm Emanuel's bark has been directed more at the progressive members of the Democratic Party and not the conservative members, the Blue Dog Democrats.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. They're really just in the middle of coming to terms on what is going to be the proposal for the health care for the nation that they're going to put forward. You have many different committees coming up with their own version, and at some point they're going to have to come up with a single version or close to a single version, and that's where we'll really see where the rubber's going to hit the road.
Yeah, and where his leadership will be tested. Bert Cohen here on Portside. We're talking with Stephen Hill, political writer and columnist and director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. And one thing Barack Obama really hung his hat on, and I made it to the 2004 speech, the speech, where he talked about there's not a blue America, not a red America, there's one America. He's been trying to somehow rise above partisanship. And there was a wonderful article a few weeks ago in the New York Times, I can't recall the author, about how Franklin Roosevelt, another powerful president, did not try to hide his partisanship. He took it on. He was, you know, he said that there are those people, and I'm paraphrasing, who hate me. Well, too bad. I'm still going to win it. So it was a very different attitude. And I wonder, you know, Obama's trying to bring people together and not have as much partisanship. But isn't partisanship absolutely necessary here? And especially considering that you have those states with very small populations that have really disproportional representation in the U.S. Senate. And doesn't Obama, I think he tried to get a start on that with that speech of a few weeks ago, the You Lie speech, I guess it's being known as now, where he started to dig in and fight. Do you see that starting to happen now? Can he get that partisan? Can he say, you know, this is how we're going to do it? And he's trying to exercise that power by getting involved in certain state elections, the election in New York State. He recognizes, I think appropriately, how important it is for certain states to have people who are supportive in there. Is he starting to meet this challenge?
Well, I think he's picking on the wrong state because, you know, Obama doesn't need to influence states in heavily Democratic New York.
Yeah.
He needs to influence states like Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska. He needs to say to the Democrats in those states who are dragging their feet people like Max Baucus and others. Look, you know, if you don't get with the program here, we're going to run a Democrat against you in the primary, and I'll put my campaigning skills and my fundraising skills behind that Democrat. I mean, that's what, ironically, someone like Tom DeLay and Karl Rove did extremely well, and it kept their party backbenchers in line. And so it seems to me that Obama, I mean, here's part of the challenge that Obama or any president has, is that unlike in other countries where you have, say, a prime minister who's the head of the government, and then a president who's the symbolic head of the country, in our political system, the president is both.
Yes.
And so it does create this kind of schizophrenic job duty, if you will, where the president has to both be the symbol of the country, which, and it's right as the symbol of the country to try and always unite the country and prevent the polarization that goes on. But then as the head of the government and the head of his party, he has to, he does have to get more partisan and to get down in the trenches and get dirty, if you will. And it's really a difficult thing to do, to play both of those roles simultaneously. And sometimes I think we really should go to more of a parliamentary system where you could have a prime minister who'd be the head of the government, could be as partisan as he or she needs to be. And then we could also have a president who's the symbolic head of the country and can use the rhetoric of unity and let's have less division and these sorts of things. But unfortunately, Obama has to do both because that's what the role of the president is.
I've long agreed with that. Sometimes people have thought I was a little bit out there for suggesting such a thing, but I can imagine somebody like Ronald Reagan as the symbol of the country, you know, tall in the saddle, nice guy, good smile, you know, somebody you'd want to be with. But to have all that political power was not such a good thing, you know. But you're right, since we have both the president and the prime minister as one person, I wonder if the changes that a lot of people are demanding can happen given that situation that you have two very different jobs in one person. I wonder if it's possible to do it. To certainly take somebody special.
It takes somebody special. I think there's two answers. The United States at this point is afflicted with political institutions that are over 200 years old. They're clearly outdated, antiquated for the 21st century. And yet changing them is going to be very, very difficult to do. It's not that easy to amend the Constitution, though there are ways to enact some of these without doing constitutional changes. However, in the meantime, the United States is going to, I think, see ourselves falling behind more and more other countries in these sorts of ways. We continue to spend huge amounts on our military that other countries aren't spending. I'm sure you and some of your listeners have seen the figures where we spend on the order of more than two or three times more than all conceivable enemies combined. And so there's a real inefficiency built into our military spending, and even beyond deciding whether or not the current actions that we're taking are really necessary and are advancing the goals of security of our country. And by that I mean, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. As well as our face-off with Iran, which seems to be coming to more and more to a head very, very early on in Obama's administration, even though he said he was going to do things differently than the Bush administration has done. And he has done them somewhat differently, but it seems like things are coming to a head again once again. So, what you're looking at a country that is spending huge amounts on the military instead of spending on we the people. And there's a fundamental choice there between guns and butter that the United States is going to have to face at some point, because economically, it's hard to imagine that the economy is going to recover to the extent it was a few years ago anytime soon. And, depending on what set of statistics you're looking at, economically speaking, we may see ourselves declining more and more over the next 10, 15, 20 years, vis-a-vis other nations in the world. Keep in mind, to decline, you don't have to really go backward. You can just stand still while other countries move forward. And in relative terms, you are falling behind. So these are the huge looming challenges that the United States has. And I have to say, if you try to think of what other political leader in the United States would be able to negotiate these challenges,
good question.
I'm hard-pressed to come up with anyone in particular. I mean, Hillary Clinton, she didn't have a great deal of experience in the Senate either.
No.
Would she have been able to do anything differently than a Barack Obama? It's really hard to say, but it's easy to imagine a scenario where things would have gone exactly the same.
Probably so. Bert Cohen here on Portside. We're talking with Stephen Hill of the New America Foundation about how much power does this president have? How much of a gamble is he taking going to Europe to lobby for the Chicago 2016 Olympics? That's sort of an interesting thing for him to be doing at this point in time. How much of a risk is that?
Well, you know, I think he's popular in Europe, so he's trying to use the influence of his presidency to do something that will boost both his home state as well as the regional economy. I mean, the Olympics are not only a great thing for prestige, but they also are a great thing for any region that gets an Olympic event because it feeds the economy.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it's almost like, you know, he's the head of the Chamber of Commerce now as well, which of course the president does play that role sometimes. So that doesn't trouble me very much. I mean, compared to the broad issues that are facing the United States, I think that's a rather small one.
Well, what if he doesn't get it? That could look kind of bad for him.
Well, I mean, you know, again, it may look bad, but I mean, you know, Americans we're so used to think of ourselves as the leader and the winner, and you know, so if he doesn't win, then suddenly that's a very bad thing, and you know, we've got to get over that. Look, the United States at this point is a leader of the world, but it's no longer the leader of the world.
Good point.
There are many, many countries out there that are doing some pretty amazing things that we can learn from. We have to sort of be more open-minded and not worry so much about, you know, will we win or lose this particular issue.
Hmm.
We have to just keep pushing forward and trying to come up with a vision that I think is going to work for the vast majority of people instead of relying on the Wall Street capitalism that we've had and relying on this sense that, you know, the United States is the leader of the world and the rest of the world should follow our lead. Because you know what? The rest of the world is not following our lead. I mean, when you travel abroad and you read the media in other countries, it's a very different conversation going on than when you read the American media. They are not so stuck on whether or not the United States is the leader of the world anymore. They're more looking for solutions. The world is looking for the successful model that is going to allow each country to provide for its people. And if the American way isn't going to be that way, the way that allows them to do that, they're going to try something else, whether it's what China is doing, which someone has called enlightened dictatorship, or whether what Europe is doing, which is more what I call social capitalism, or some other method, you know, Russian autocracy. I mean, there are a lot of countries out there. What one of my colleagues at the New America Foundation, Parag Khanna, has called the second world. And they're, in a sense, the world's swing voters. They are looking to see what model, what method is going to help them provide for their people. And the American way is just one of those, and in many ways not even the best in many, many ways when you start adding up the pluses and minuses.
Well, so much has been about saving face, looking strong, you know, having that, you know, holding that macho position as the leader of the free world for the past 60 years. And that's being tested big time in Afghanistan. Now there, Obama says, you know, it's not about saving face, but it'll be really fascinating to see what he does about Afghanistan. Military victory is not possible in Afghanistan. He's not LBJ, who didn't have a precedent to look at. Obama has the precedent to look at called Vietnam, which really destroyed LBJ. You know, as he tried to save face, and I think certainly that the rest of the world, the second world, is recognizing that this is kind of nuts, you know, to try to occupy yet another country. And as Winston Churchill recognized, I believe it was, of Afghanistan, it's the, you know, the graveyard of empires. And this will be an interesting test of him, too. And I wonder, you know, if that brings up the question, are we expecting too much of this one person? We have, you and I agree that, you know, having so much power in one person, being the president and the prime minister in one person, the symbol of the country as well as the head of government, that's a problem. Are we expecting too much?
Well, of course we're expecting too much. I mean, that's the job of the presidency is to do a lot of great things. I mean, Americans sometimes are the ultimate a free lunch society. We want all these things. We want a good life, but we don't really want to pay for them.
Yes.
And of course, that's true of, you know, people all over the world, but it is sort of more American-like to, for example, not want to. We complain a lot about our taxes and forget that our taxes, and to some degree, as long as they're used efficiently, are our membership dues in a society that prevents us from sinking backwards into a time when I think most Americans wouldn't have enjoyed living in the United States 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or what have you. You know, they, Americans like having their services, their roads, their schools, their football and baseball stadiums, you know, all the things, the perks of living and being an American. And so we expect American presidents to keep producing this quality of life, and yet we don't really want to pay for it, and we forget that this quality of life is a historical phenomenon. It is a post-World War II in which America did emerge as the leader of the world phenomenon, and that time period has pretty much passed. The benefits that we had from being the, you know, economic, political, military leader of the world are, I think, it pretty, you know, we're still in the red dwarf years, if you will, of that time period. But we're moving into a new time period in which the United States is going to have to become much more smarter, much more efficient. Our institutions have got to be redesigned to make us a country for the 21st century and not for the 20th century. And we're going to have to be smarter about how we use our hard power, our military power, and use something more, what I call smart power. Being, you know, we have a military stick, but we, in some ways, once you use that stick, you actually, if you don't succeed, you actually lose ground more than if you had just kept threatening to use it. And so these are the lessons that I think the United States is in the process of learning. And I think we will learn those lessons, but it happens over a period of decades. And, you know, and each year as it goes by, you can see the ways that we aren't learning and the anxiety produced by the fact that we can't always see the way forward. But I think the United States, you know, as a people, we are resilient. We have been for many, many years. And there are great things about this country as well. So I think we're going to make these transitions and these changes, but it's going to take time.
Yeah, it does seem that a lot of the people are more ready to make that change and are willing to no longer dominate the world. I mean, there's certainly tremendous resistance to doing that. There are people who believe, like, well, when I hear politicians say, well, America is the greatest country in the world, obviously, they haven't been to a lot of other places, specifically Italy, I think, because I think that's a wonderful country. But that to recognize that, I think most, you know, Americans, working Americans, feel like, do we really need to dominate and control the world? You have said in your article, it appears that the wheels may be coming off the world's post-war leader, and not even Barack Obama can stop that happening. Well, is that a bad thing? Does the U.S. need to retain its hegemony over the world? Maybe we can adjust. Maybe it can be better if we don't have to dominate the world.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just in terms of resources, if we were putting less into the military, and keeping in mind, again, it's about the security of our nation, and we're spending three times as much as all conceivable enemies combined. So we have, I think, something like 700 military bases all over the world. That's expensive to keep military bases all over the world. You know, I think we can be more efficient in our spending and still have the security that we as a nation need by joining with our allies around the world. And we do have lots of allies. There are lots of people that really still look to America to lead in these ways. And so we could lead by creating a true coalition of the willing, by asking the partners what it is you think we ought to be doing, instead of, you know, rushing into war in Iraq or into Afghanistan. You know, we did in a very emotional time after September 11th terrorist attacks. And, you know, it's 10 years later, and we're still looking for Osama bin Laden. Leaving aside the moral, political, all the different aspects, it's expensive to do this. That money could be better spent, I think, and make our nation more secure by putting it into the institutions and the practices that other countries are using to make their people stronger, healthier, better fed, better clothed, better health care, better everything, and really allowing the United States to be an important leader in the world, but one of many leaders in the world. I think that's the direction that the country clearly needs to go in. And in that light, you have to ask yourself, what the heck are we doing in Afghanistan? Right. This is a country that has a GDP that is less than the state of Rhode Island.
Wow.
The idea that Afghanistan can somehow be a threat to the United States, even leaving aside that they might try to rebuild the camps in Afghanistan, the Taliban camps and Al-Qaeda and these sorts of things, we can keep better watch on them. We have the means to do that and to figure out other ways to make our country secure without putting American women and men in harm's way in Afghanistan and Iraq, and by spending huge, huge amounts of money that can be better spent right here in the United States.
We're talking with Stephen Hill of the New America Foundation about how much power does Obama have? Is he impotent, as some people have suggested? And Afghanistan, certainly there could be different methods. I mean, one of my favorites, George McGovern, talked many years ago back in the Cold War that we could do more to dry up the swamplands of despair that breed communism at the time. Now you could just change that to terrorism with our medical help, agricultural help, technical help, then with all the military hardware and arsenal. But it's not so profitable for the military contractors. And it brings us back to the point of who has the real power in the United States. It seems like the military has always done very, very well. The contractors, the weapons makers. But does that make us stronger? Not particularly. We were attacked September 11th. All the hundreds of billions of dollars we had spent didn't make any difference whatsoever because somebody got in there. Talking about economic strength of the United States, that's been a concern of the other leading countries of the world. They're concerned about whether or not the Obama administration is showing appropriate leadership in making real reforms designed to avoid a repetition of the global economic collapse. I wonder, is there enough pressure on Wall Street, or does Wall Street still have that much political power over Washington? And I wonder if in answering that, you could compare our efforts with those of Europe, where they're talking about a financial police force. I can't imagine something like that happening here. I wonder if you could comment on those issues.
Right. Well, Europe, we just had the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh, in which a lot of these issues were discussed. And the reportage in the United States was much different than the reporting coming from other parts of the world, which, in the United States, it sort of made it sound like, oh, they pretty much all agreed and came up with goals that were similar. But in fact, Europe is expressing quite a lot of impatience with the United States. Europe has been leading on wanting to impose new rules, for example, on executive pay and bonuses, requiring that banks link pay to long-term rather than short-term performance. And then also having what they call a clawback. So any bonuses that are received, say today, and then you know your company has losses for the next 3 years, you have to give that money back. It's called a clawback. And this, it's not just a matter of getting even with the bankers and the corporate leaders that basically drag the global economy underwater. It's more a matter of that the incentives of the system today are perversely encouraging of taking risks with other people's money, because you make a lot of money, and if something goes bad, you don't have to worry about it because the government bails you out. It's what's called moral hazard. And so Europe is really much more than the United States, much more than the Geithner-led part of the Obama administration, is trying to come up with ways to change the incentives of the system. And they found the U.S. to not be very receptive to this. The U.S. is in fact, Barack Obama at one point was asked in an interview about this, and he said, why is it that we're going to cap executive compensation for Wall Street bankers but not Silicon Valley entrepreneurs or NFL football players? And which is quite a stunning statement coming from Barack Obama. You might expect Timothy Geithner to say something like this, but for Barack Obama to say something like this, first of all, Paul Krugman pointed out, the National Football League actually does have salary restrictions. They're team restrictions rather than individual restrictions, but the impact is substantially the same. And also, when Silicon Valley businesses or NFL quarterbacks have a bad year or a bad game, they don't cause an economic collapse. And so equating them is just truly a stunning statement. It's the type of thing where if David Letterman read that quote on his TV show and asked his audience, who made this clueless statement? Was it former President Bush or President Obama? 98% of people would have said, oh, it must have been George W. Bush. So it's when you start making statements like this that reveal what I see as just kind of an ignorance of the situation. It's very troubling to see that coming from Barack Obama, who, you know, I think is a very intelligent person, a great communicator, and yet to have him make statements like this just makes Europe and other parts of the world say, my God, what are we dealing with here? You know, so in response to this sort of foot-dragging, various European leaders have been saying, well, look, Europe is just going to act on its own. It's going to pass these reforms because the European economy is actually the largest economy in the world.
Sure.
It's actually it's almost as large as the U.S. and Chinese economies combined. So when Europe decides to pass laws, it has ramifications throughout the world. And so they're saying, we're just going to move forward without the Obama administration because we can't afford to wait. They're just, you know, they're not getting it. They're not doing what we think is necessary. We just can't afford to wait. So, you know, there's other things that have been proposed, you know, where Europe is just taking the lead on these sorts of things and on banking and re-regulation of the financial industry, and the United States is lagging behind.
Well, one of the difficulties, of course, is you have somebody on the right like Mike Huckabee, who recently said that we should just tear down the United Nations, literally take the building out of New York City. You know, so Obama has to deal with people on the right. I mean, this guy may be running for president in 2012, so he has those political forces to deal with as well. The you know, it's kind of nuts, in my opinion, but to totally reject that, and that is a portion of the United States. And in terms of actually making change, perhaps to answer your column on the Huffington Post, there was a response in there, I think, from Dylan Lowe saying that, you know, there really have been a lot of changes since Obama became president. And just briefly list some of those. The stimulus bill has over $60 billion in renewable energy investment. The Equal Pay Act is now law. Federal restrictions on stem cells are over. Obama delivered the middle class tax cut. There's broader transparency, and that he's withdrawing forces from Iraq. His Justice Department has initiated a torture probe. The DEA has been ordered to stop raiding medical marijuana dispensaries. He's looking at Afghanistan with a critical skepticism, and you know he's taking into account the concerns that anti-war Democrats have had. He prohibited the use of torture in the United States. So he's making some real changes here. And given the difficulties of the U.S. Senate, which again has been called the a place where good bills go to die, he is actually making some changes. Do you expect that, you know, given the political realities here, that this is about as much as he could do? Or do you think he could do more? Do you expect him to be able to do more? Will he be able to do more?
Well, we'll see. A lot of us are hoping that he will do more. But as you say, the institutional barriers, the political barriers are significant. And again, it's sort of, you know, when the rest of the world is moving forward, you don't have to. You can stand still and fall behind. And under the Bush administration, there's no question that at best we stood still, and as a result, we fell behind. And so So Obama right now is expending huge amounts of political capital trying to pass health care. But this is something that most of the established nations of the world already have.
Sure.
So they're not working on something like health care. They're working on revamping their economies to make them more green.
Yeah.
And you know, Germany and other places, they're the ones that are getting all the jobs from green technology and other sorts of technologies that are being implemented around the world, and it's going to become part of their export economy. It already has become. They've created millions of jobs across Europe just in green jobs. And so, you know, Obama certainly, I think, has the vision to turn the ship in a better way. But the United States just has so many ways that we've fallen behind at this point that it's going to take time. All of it's probably not going to happen under the Obama administration, even if he has 8 years. And what comes after the Obama administration, you know, do we end up with another Republican who takes us backwards again?
Yeah.
If we do this sort of yo-yo thing, then the net gain-loss over time is to stand still.
Mm.
So, you know, these are the big questions. And, of course, no one has the crystal ball that can answer it for us. We can just hope that Barack Obama is able to negotiate these many minefields that are there in the American political system, and Well, as well as the attitudes of, you know, of a very segment of the American people who want to go into more of an isolationist direction like Mike Huckabee. When people feel, there's this interesting reaction that happens in the United States where people see that we're not being appreciated. They also see that our country is you know, not doing particularly well. And there's this tendency to want to pull in and say, the heck with the rest of the world. Right. We don't need them. We're the United States of America. So it both props up people's feelings about their country, as well as gives them this fantasy that somehow by withdrawing into ourselves that we can just survive without the rest of the world. Well, let me tell you, we would be we'd be far worse if we were to go in that direction. But I wouldn't put it past the American people or a certain segment of the American people to vote in that way in the 2010 and 2012 elections. So this is a book that's being written even as we discuss it here today on your show.
Well, just one last point. It looks like I'm wondering if when healthcare passes, as I believe something will, I don't know if it'll have the public option, but at that point, maybe he'll somehow be empowered. Maybe that's why he's investing so much in it, because maybe that'll sort of give him more power in the U.S. Senate. We don't know. Well, thank you so much, Stephen Hill, for being with us today. If people want more information about your work, I assume there's some website with the New America Foundation?
Yeah, the easiest one would be www.stephen-hill.org, which has references to my various writings and such. So that's STEVEN-HILL.org.
Look forward to talking with you again about so many other subjects. Thanks so much for being with us.
And my upcoming book, Europe's Promise, there's a website for that, which is just europespromise.org, one word.
All right. Well, thank you so much today for being with us to talk about the strength of Obama. And it is said by our artist here, Graham Parker, that you really can't be too strong. Thanks for listening to Portside.
Did they tear it out with talons of steel and give you a shot so that you wouldn't feel, and washed it away as if it wasn't real? It's just a mistake I won't have to face. Don't give it a name, don't give it a place, don't give it a chance. It's lucky in a way. It must have felt strange to find me inside you. I had unintended to stay. If you wanna keep it right, put it to sleep at night. Squeeze it until it could say, you can't be too strong. You can't be too strong. Can't be too strong. Can't be too strong. You decide what's wrong. Well, I ain't gonna cry. I'm gonna rejoice and shout myself dry and go see the boys. They'll laugh when I say I left it overseas. Yeah, babe, I know it gets dark down by Luna Park, but everybody else is squeezing out a spark that happened in the heat somewhere in the dark. In the dark. The doctor gets nervous, completing the service is our rubber gloves and no head. Yes, he fumbles the light switch, it's just another minor hitch. Wishes to God he was dead, but you can't be too strong. You can't be too strong. You can't be too strong. Too strong. You decide what's wrong. Can be too hard, too tough.